Fellow malcontents, welcome to the Marxist School at Sacramento. Thanks very much for coming out tonight. We're in for a delightful evening. Our speakers tonight are Terry Bassan, to my right, and Rob McBride, also to my right, moving to my left here. Gentlemen are going to speak tonight about a memoir of David Milgram, who was a political activist, revolutionary during the 1960s. He was in SCS, the Weatherman. They're going to speak in part about not only David Gilbert, but also the times that he lived in as history, and also as those times, and David Gilbert, through his memoir, live on today in the present time. Before Terry and Rob get started, I'd just like to let everybody know that we have our point of view lecture series and discussions, which we hold at SMUD on 63rd and S Street in the back, along with a sign-up sheet. We don't sell your name to Glenn Beck or any of those marvelous folks out there in the rest of the world. And without any further
ado,
the cell phones. Yeah, if you have a cell phone, if you please mute it or turn it off.
And if it buzzes in your pocket and you want to answer it, walk out before starting to talk.
David Gilbert's memoir is Love and Struggle. It's available from PM Press, headed up by Ramsey Kanaan in the back. It'll be available later. Right now, it's up to you. So without any further ado, Rob McBride, Terry Bassan. Thank you very much for coming out.
Well, this is a real treat. Thank you all for coming out. I'm going to say a couple of words. I'm an editor with PM Press, and it was my privilege to be the editor on this book. And also, I'm an old friend of the author, and I've worked with him on a number of other books. So we're here to talk about the book, and also about him, and also about how the struggles in the 60s, because that's what this book is about, relate to the left and the struggles of today. And hopefully we'll get into a few controversial topics, because Weather Underground was nothing if not controversial, more controversial probably then than it is today. David Gilbert has been a political prisoner for 30 years, and this book is a product of a struggle he had with his son, who wanted him to write a book about his experiences in prison. David didn't want to write that book. He wanted to write a book about the experiences that led to him going to prison, that led to him becoming a revolutionary, and tell the story, the trajectory of the story, not only of himself personally, but of the history of the movement of a part of the white left that played a key role in the anti-war and anti-racist movement of the 60s. The arc of this book, which really begins in the late 50s and the early 60s with the civil rights movement, starts when David was a high school student in the suburbs of Boston, Mass. And he was from a liberal family.
Is that a mic that's operating with help?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. Excuse me. Yeah, just pass me the thing and I'll do it. I'm sorry. So in many ways, it's the struggle, it's the memoir of somebody who went from being a liberal to a radical to a revolutionary in an incredibly short period of time, of about less than 10 years. But the importance of the book, as I see it, is not only the story of David, it's the story of a generation. It's the generation that with the generation that sort of came of age in the 1960s through the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement. The trajectory of the book, the story, the passage, if you will, the book goes from David went to Columbia University. He was a middle-class kid from a middle-class family. Went to Columbia University, took part in the student strike, became radicalized by dealing with the the student strike at Columbia didn't have to do with tuition or grades. It had to do with Columbia's forays and takeovers of areas in Harlem, and the racism that he saw in New York, and the racism that he saw playing out in the Vietnam War. David was not a founder of SDS, but he was one of the people that joined. SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, went from a very small liberal sort of almost think tank of sort of bright intellectual kids to becoming a huge mass movement of students against the war. And as that happened, David and the other members of SDS grew more and more radical and built, in many ways, helped to build the movement against the war. Other student groups like the Black Panthers and SNCC, which grew out of the civil rights movement, were operating at the same time. It was an enormously exciting and turbulent time. This book covers the student strike, David's work as an organizer with SDS, and then SDS, as it became more radical, actually split and became more internationally focused, and focusing on the war not as a mistake in the U.S. but as part of an imperialist system, and they decided to take up arms and to become more militant and to go underground against the U.S. and as they the imperialist system as they saw it. They formed what was probably the first clandestine network in the U.S. Since the abolitionist, the Underground Railroad at the time of the Civil War. And then SDS, as it developed, there were a lot of struggles against sexism within SDS, struggles within racism, debates about armed struggle, about clandestinity, about leadership, and how this stuff developed, not only in David's head, but in actual struggles between the different organizations and people doing the work of building the movement in those days. That's the importance to me of the book. It's not just a personal memoir. It's a memoir that many, many of us went through in one form or another. And at the end of it, the reason David is in jail is because long after the Weather Underground broke up, he was operating with a section of the Black Liberation Army, which had grown out of the Black Panthers when they'd been driven underground by the police attacks. And David took part in an expropriation, an armed robbery, if you will, of a Brinks truck, and it was a disaster. Several people were killed, several people were captured. David and three or four others went to jail. David is still in prison today for that, but he's still an activist. He's still a mentor to many people, and he's still a working author, and he wrote this book in an effort not only to tell his story, but to communicate with another generation of activists about the struggles that they've been through and how he hoped it would relate to what's happening today and help inform and not only to shape but to learn from it, to dialogue with activists today. And that's why we're here, both as still comrades of him, but also people active in the left. So to begin with that, we just wanted to give an idea of what the book is by reading a couple of short sections from it to give you an idea of what of how it's written and what he's talking about. So I'm going to turn to Rob to begin with that.
And let me know if you can hear me well or not. I'm not used to using a microphone, but I know I need one. So the arc of David's political life that he describes in the book is very close to mine. I did not meet him until he was already underground with the Weather Underground organization. I was not in that, but I worked with it. But even his childhood and earliest liberal civil rights efforts resonate very much with my own political growing up. And, you know, this is the Marxist school. For David, as well as for many of us, it was really extremely difficult psychically to become a Marxist. I know for me, I just resisted it as fiercely as I could, even after I was very much in support of the civil rights movement and furious at the government and not only anti-war but pro-Vietnamese, but still the idea of becoming Marxist was just beyond the pale. It was a struggle for him too. So when he was at Columbia as an undergraduate, he was active in SDS, as we mentioned. So I'm just reading a couple of paragraphs about his intellectual struggles around that. Whoops, and I turned to the wrong one. Hold on. Okay. Pardon me. I did not... Is this okay? Sound wise? I did not start with reading Marx and Lenin. Instead, I was devouring business magazines like Fortune and Business Week, with their emphasis on the need to open up new markets in the third world. Others in the new wave of SDS activists were examining the same issues. David Loud of Harvard's chapter was writing a history of how the US emerged as an imperial power. We combined that work in 1967 to write the first national SDS pamphlet that named the system US imperialism. I am proud of that contribution, but it certainly had its shortcomings theoretically. When I was working on it, a friend in the Columbia Student Afro-American Society tactfully cautioned me, "That's fine, but there are already some high-powered thinkers who've written on it. You might check out Lenin." Well, while I did read Lenin, I followed the business magazines in zeroing in on new markets. What was best about the pamphlet that he and David Loud wrote, the Breakthrough to Imperialism, this is a copy of it. What was best about the pamphlet was the opening I did with 8 key examples from Guatemala to Iran to Indonesia of destructive and anti-democratic US interventions. Despite its weaknesses theoretically, the pamphlet was a crucial advance. While the old SDS leadership defined the system with the contentless phrase corporate liberalism, we were now thinking in terms of imperialism, which both captured the international scope of the capitalist economy and helped explain the centrality of the national liberation movements. Along with the inspiration from abroad, our movement faced a crisis within the US, one that SNCC had understood and articulated in 1966 when they called for black power. Our idealism had failed to turn America around. In fact, power was becoming more entrenched and repressive. Black activists in particular were being imprisoned and killed. Even for those of us sheltered on campus, our disruptions of the war machine were met with the possibility of expulsion, which would subject the males to the wartime draft. Moral protest was not enough. We needed a clearer analysis of society. Ardent students did not have the power to overthrow the government. We needed to find a bigger agency for social change. Broad sectors of SDS turned to Marxism for a way to solve the crisis. Those of us interested in women's liberation began to read an emerging set of theorists using Marxism to develop feminist analysis, such as Eleanor Leacock, Juliet Mitchell, Sheila Robotham. I just want to add personally that this was very much the path that I saw all around me when I was in Madison, Wisconsin, SDS, that so many of us followed. For me personally, it was Business Week and the business section of the New York Times that really finally drove me to thinking that Marxism did indeed have some explanatory power.
As SDS became, SDS, for those that don't know, was Students for a Democratic Society, which I believe was formed by the AFL-CIO in the original.
It was the Student League for Industrial Democracy.
Yes.
Okay. And the idea was to create a generation of informed citizens, which it did, but not in exactly the way they planned. As SDS became more radical, it began to split within itself between the more radical and less radical factions within it. And at a big convention, it all kind of came to pass. That's the section I'm going to read. Check it out. The photo in the National Guardian of the crowd standing and cheering Bernadine Dorn's speech expelling progressive labor from SDS at the June 1969 National Convention. That's me in the middle of the picture waving a clenched fist and looking a bit dazed. My stunned look comes from being simultaneously staggered and inspired. For several years now, I've thought of myself as an SDS organizer, and that's been the most satisfying identity of my life. It expresses me and more than me. SD organizer stands for something out there in the world, a visible set of humane, radical values that I've tried to put into practice. Now I'm staggered because with this catastrophic split, does SDS mean anything at all? A clear tendency as the convention is being, as people are planning to go to this convention, there's a split between progressive labor, which is a sort of an old line Marxist group, which believes that the most revolutionary force in the country is the industrial working class, like the UAW or the AFL-CIO, and the more youth-oriented tendencies, which call themselves the Revolutionary Youth Movement. Who were into SNCC, the Students for a Nonviolent Coordinating, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and the Black Panthers, and they call themselves REM, or the Revolutionary Youth Movement. So here's how David puts it: a clear tendency within REM crystallized with the Weatherman paper published in the June 69 convention issue of New Left Notes. The full title was a line from Bob Dylan's Subterranean Homesick Blues. You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. I was sure that the title was a creative way to say you don't need elaborate Marxist theory to see that the revolutionary upsurge of our era is coming out of the third world. When I gave my interpretation to one of the authors of the paper, he said, nope. The line doesn't mean anything in particular. It just happened to be the song on the stereo when it was time to pick a title. Regardless, the line resonated with me. Most Western Marxists insisted that the working class in the industrialized countries was the most revolutionary force. That dogma flew in the face of reality, and the strategy based on that view repeated the errors through the U.S. history that had led to building unions that turned out to be racist, sexist, and pro-imperialist. Since the end of World War II, every single struggle that overturned or even seriously threatened the old state power, with the partial exception of France in 68, had come from the Third World. Within the U.S., the Black, the Native American, Puerto Rican, and Chicano liberation movements, as well as the Asian American anti-racist struggles, had done far more than the mostly white union movement to inspire and lead the movement for social change. The Weather paper's position was abundantly clear. The Black struggle wasn't beholden to the white population. Racism was totally central to what America was about. Our job wasn't to tell them to wait, but to minimize casualties and speed victory by mobilizing support. I especially like the emphasis on building a white fighting force in solidarity and for revolution. Working relationships with some of the authors made me predisposed to like the Weather paper. Even if a few arguments seemed awkward or exaggerated, overall, it was the best statement I'd seen from our movement on the leading role of national liberation worldwide, the centrality of the black struggle in the U.S., and the urgent need for, and potential for building a militant anti-imperialist movement. After reading the paper, I was happy to call myself a weatherman. At the convention, the factional fighting was ferocious. Every single detail and even the order of the agenda was cause for battle. Political struggle got reduced to name-calling. I took a turn at the mic and talked about how PL's position was, in effect, racist. The PL speaker who followed retorted that I was clearly anti-working class. We wanted to organize working class youth, but not the traditional way in the factories. Our problem with PL was that even though they verbally opposed racism, they refused to support the leading struggles of the day. Their position that all nationalism is reactionary denied the very independence and self-determination that oppressed people had been fighting for. When PL members who had hardly thrown a brick or even had even opposed the Columbia strike denounced the Vietnamese for selling out in agreeing to peace negotiations, Clayton Van Lidegraaff, a longtime communist who had left PL for this very reason, thundered back, "PL is very courageous. They're willing to fight U.S. imperialism to the last drop of Vietnamese blood." While PL had done a much better job of bringing people to the convention, our strong point was our alliance with the Panthers, still revered by much of the left. On and on the battle raged. At a certain point, it became clear that while definitely not representing majority of members nationwide, PL had brought enough delegates to win crucial votes, perhaps enough to be able to turn SDS into its opposite, something we would not allow. Bernadine Dorn led a walkout of almost half the delegates, which entailed a certain contradiction to formal democracy. Who were we to expel them, since they were the majority? The answer was articulated in Bernadine's historic speech. Democracy was not defined by the vote at one packed meeting. Bernadine went back to the inception, growth, and history of SDS. We were born in response to the courageous breakthroughs of the civil rights movement. We had been nurtured and mentored by a special fraternal relationship with SNCC. We had blossomed and grown to be the national organization spearheading opposition to the war and educating white youth about imperialism. We had been inspired by and learned much of what we knew from the national liberation movements in the Third World and the determined struggles of people of color within the U.S. Solidarity with the black struggle and with national liberation worldwide had both created who we were and defined our bedrock principles. People who turned on the Panthers and the Vietnamese when they were under fire were a total contradiction to what SDS was all about. We would now carry forward our principles in a clearer and more determined way. Read another piece.
Yeah, one reason I like the book so much is that, you know, as I said before, I'll repeat myself, you know, it really captured a lot of the transitions that I and many friends, and even not so friendly friends, but other people, activists at the same time, were going through. I've read a number of the memoirs written from the time. I know you've heard from Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz here, and you know her three-part memoir is just terrific. Among the veterans of SDS, Weather, and similar formations, I like this one much the best because of the balance between recounting a personal development and the political developments of the time. It's the most integrated by far, and I recommend it on that basis. One reason I read the passage I did before is because speaking here made me think about becoming Marxist and how hard that was. But it also brings up a challenge for today. I don't think that many people becoming active and activists today are going to be moved by reading Fortune and Business Week, although some might. Also, I don't think many will be deepened in their activism by having us wave Marx and Engels at them. And so I want to really pose the challenge to, you know, in the discussion I hope we get to in a little bit about what's a parallel kind of experience today, or experiences, I'm sure, of deepening radicalism. Another passage that I want to read, very short, speaks to the tremendous optimism that David and so many of us felt at the time. Even though I felt it then, it sometimes feels very weird looking back on it. How could we have been so optimistic? Right. But we were not alone. It was felt around the world. It was felt by the forces of repression in the state as well as the forces of the left. But having grown up very much in the Cold War, my father helped to build atomic bombs. He wanted to build a bomb shelter. I was terrified of atomic war, with good reason, I think. Anyway, it was a tremendous breakthrough for me, and David captures it in this paragraph, to come to understand that the war in Vietnam wasn't simply bad on the U.S. part, but inspiring on the Vietnamese part. Anarchism had the appeal of a freewheeling cultural spirit and the critique of hierarchy, but Marxism seemed to have a more coherent and useful analysis of society. But what totally tipped the balance for me, and for thousands more, was what was happening in the larger world. Revolutions were sweeping the planet, and almost all of them, especially the ones involving the most oppressed and pushing for fundamental economic changes, were led by Marxist-Leninist parties. Just in our lifetime, at a pace unprecedented in human history, there had been revolutions in China, Cuba, North Korea, Ghana, and Algeria. The world was on fire with people's war in Vietnam and all of Indochina, the Philippines, Palestine, Eritrea, South Africa, Zimbabwe, the three Portuguese colonies in Africa, Angola, Mozambique, and Guinea-Bissau, and guerrillas were operating throughout Latin America. It was breathtaking, and it underlay the tremendous hope for dramatic social change that infused the youth rebellion of the 1960s. So I read that as a challenge to try to imagine or remember, depending on your age, you know, that period, and to think about what may be comparable today.
On the same note, David says, what most distinguished the 60s from previous and subsequent decades was the tremendous hope we felt, a hope expressed in the youth culture's sense of a universal brotherhood and a vision of peace. That hope rose from the reality of dramatic contemporary developments. The most oppressed people in the world were rising and had a real chance to win by overextending the imperial monster. Che's idea of two, three, many Vietnams, and we would be part of that. But there was another side to it too, which David also expressed, I wanted to bring up. Our SDS chapter is having a meeting to discuss some kind of strategic impasse, but we're floundering. Lily gets to speak and makes some good suggestions, provides a skeleton that could be fleshed out into a good program. But the next five speakers don't mention her or what she said as they continue to meander. Then a male graduate student, considered brilliant, paraphrases Lily, undoubtedly not even conscious that he got his great ideas from her. All of a sudden, everyone responds and we're on our way. Later, when I ask Lily about it, she just shrugs and says, sure, it always happens that way. I'm just glad we can move things forward. Women were central and critical to the early anti-war movement, not only as consistent workers, but also as initiators and strategists. But in those days, almost all the visible speakers and leaders were male. Typically, one organizational office was held by a woman, secretary. SDS's first, by 67, women started to demand to be heard. The modern women's movement, the second wave of feminism, the first wave culminated in women's right to vote in 1920. In many ways, this second wave sprang out of the early civil rights movement. Once racism was exposed and the lie of equal rights cracked open, other people, including women, began to articulate how they were oppressed and their need to fight. SDS's first Women's Liberation Caucus was held in June 67 at the National Convention in Ann Arbor, Michigan. The way the workshop was put on the agenda was almost accidental. During the planning session at the spring meeting of the National Council, someone was at the blackboard writing down a list of topics. Betty, very bright and extremely shy, was sitting next to me, and she whispered, "We should have one on women's liberation." So I raised my hand and made the proposal, and it was added to the list without any discussion or thought about its political significance. My friend Naomi and I went on to this national conference together, and she was clearly excited by what was happening in the workshop. Even those of us not attending the sessions could feel the electricity in the mix as we walked by the circle of women sitting on the lawn. As with all the workshops, their chair presented a report to the plenary. But when Marilyn Buck took the stage to do so, all hell broke loose. Men hooted and whistled from the floor, threw paper plates, paper planes at Marilyn, and shouted such gems as, "I'll liberate you with my cock." It was more than upsetting. SDS was supposed to always side with the oppressed. Even with a, quote, new, unquote, issue, it was hard to understand why SDS men wouldn't sympathize or at least listen. The circus response revealed the depth of sexism within SDS. Marilyn was amazing in the dignified and determined way she chaired the session. She never lowered herself to respond in kind to the catcalls and insults hurled at her, but neither did she retreat an inch in the face of the attack. While there was vociferous opposition, many other people spoke in favor of the proposal, mainly women, but also a couple of men. The report was completed and accepted. Women's liberation had at least breached the sexist ramparts of the new left.
Read another one.
No.
Yeah.
I've got one more.
I want to second that. That, of course, continues to be a very hot and difficult contradiction to work out today. But Marilyn Buck has contributed a lot ever since that first report in the SDS convention. She passed away about a year and a half ago. So now her contributions are through example and writings. She was also a political prisoner up until the last 2 weeks of her life. She got out after she had terminal cancer. But there is a chapbook of her poetry. There are many articles and essays available on the web, scattered across different publications. And she has a major collection of poetry coming out from City Lights later this year. So I just want to give a heads up, to look for that. The Weather Underground, of course, has made a name for itself with bombing the U.S. Capitol building, Kennecott Copper headquarters, the Police Benevolent Association in New York City, the Naval War College, and many military and major corporate targets. These were done, it feels funny to even describe them as bombings now, because they were small pipe bombs in places that were not occupied and with a warning called in. The first one ended up cutting some, I think it was policemen, with some glass. And after that, nobody was hurt with it. But although the weather underground lasted for some 6 years and made a name for itself, they were not the only ones doing this at all. And it's important in terms of trying to understand that history to see that context. I know where I was in Madison, Wisconsin, there were numerous firebombings of the ROTC building. They had a little Quonset hut where they met and had classes and drilled and so forth.
Don't know what ROTC is.
Oh yes, Reserve Officer Training Corps. Thank you. Slipping back into acronyms.
And the fact that they were on campuses, they were actually part of the university.
Yes, that's right.
I had ROTC in high school, required.
Oh, that's right.
Anyway.
So there was an ROTC military building on campus that got burned to the ground. And one thing that was interesting about that is that it happened in broad daylight with about 2,000 people around it.
This is in Madison?
Yeah, in Madison, Wisconsin, yes. SDS and the Committee Against the War in Vietnam and the Wisconsin Draft Resistance Union and the Women's Liberation Affinity Groups, which were not a single organization but very active affinity groups, and others, you know, had repeated anti-war demonstrations, and we would march on different targets at different ones. And one of the times we marched on the ROTC building and somebody just went ahead and torched it. That was not the only one. There were, you know, banks and other...
Was it at UW? The University of Wisconsin?
Yes.
And the main campus?
Yes, in Madison.
What year did that happen?
That would have been 1970.
So, concurrent with Kent State?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Right, exactly.
Why
Kent State was...
That?
Excuse me?
Why don't I remember that? That was 19th birthday at Kent State.
Right.
You were at Kent State? Were you at Kent State?
I was in Cleveland, and Kent State happened on my 18th birthday.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, I was in Cleveland, and they said they should have shot more of them.
Yes.
The business aspect, which is now
But I repeat the Madison example because I was there. It's very vivid. But there were about 1,000 incidents of arson against recruiting centers on and off campus and other related military buildings in the U.S. over that 18-month period. So while the weather underground is the best documented and was the most continuous, the actions that they took, the armed actions, were very much part of a wave of political movement. One thing, and I will read, there was a very major Army Math Research Center in Madison that was developing new methods of artillery fire and bombing for use in the war in Vietnam. And so we had had repeated demonstrations against them, moves to get them off. And then somebody took a further action. So let me read this paragraph from David. At the time, there were several small armed struggle groups totally unrelated to us. In August 1970, anti-imperialist activists blew up a major war research center, the Army Math Building, at the University of Wisconsin. Even though the blast occurred at 3:40 a.m., a graduate student who was unexpectedly in the building to do some late-night research was killed. We had extensive discussions on how to do our best to see that other groups did not make such deadly mistakes, and on how to set a clear example on safety for the other armed struggle groups that were emerging. And I can second that. That was one of the things that I was involved with in doing support work for the WO. While they were very dedicated to saying that the ability of the U.S. to make war had to be physically and materially opposed, they spent as much or more time arguing that this has to be done in congruence with open, above-board, public mass struggle, and it has to be done in a way that targets property in a propagandistic way rather than in a militaristic way. The idea that we could do significant military damage was completely crazy, and it had to be done as political work.
Let me read some on that. The phone rings in the middle of the night. Three of our people, including Teddy, were killed in an explosion yesterday. I can't go into details on the phone, but we think the police did it. We'll get back to you when we know more. In the meanwhile, watch your back. The night I got the phone call, I was shaken to my core. Three of our people, including my best friend, Teddy Gold, suddenly dead. My grief was compounded by real fears. In the context of what was being done to the Panthers, the police attack version was credible. And in Denver, we were under intense surveillance. Were we being set up for the kill? When a Weather Bureau member made it to Denver a couple of weeks later, we got the real story. Our own people had accidentally caused the explosion as they frantically rushed to build bombs. The two others killed in this tragedy were later identified as Diana Auten and Terry Robbins. Two women who had been on another floor of the collapsing townhouse had managed to escape both death and arrest. Our small group in Denver was the only one of our collectives without a Weather Bureau member being the leadership, which left us isolated from many internal political debates. This Bureau visit was to bring us into the debate raging after the townhouse between militarism and building a revolutionary youth movement. Militarism was defined as determining effectiveness by the size of the armed blows against imperialism. I didn't learn until much later that the politics that led to the townhouse explosion went beyond militarism. The planned action directed at a military bowl would have killed some officers and their dates, thus sinking into a cavalier attitude toward human life and collateral damage, all too reminiscent of the U.S. government. The alternative to militarism had a role for armed struggle, but only as an integral component of the overriding goal of building a bigger and more militant revolutionary movement. Organizing was key, and actions were to be evaluated not based on the size of the bang, but for their impact on consciousness. The Bureau members who led the struggle against militarism, Bernadine Dorn, Jeff Jones, and Bill Ayers, thought that our Denver collective would be a strong ally. In contrast to the New York collective, where the explosion had taken place, we had never stopped working with and trying to organize white youth. We used a range of tactics, and even our small armed actions did only minimal damage. But by the time they got to Denver to talk to us, I had flipped out and brought most of the collective with me. Out of my mind with grief for Teddy, my response was to feel compelled to carry out his mission, again, with no idea that the New York targets had included people. I was focused on what we could do to stop the war machine and the police repression of the Panthers. For example, the U.S. was straining its air capacity with saturation bombings in Vietnam, killing many civilians. Wouldn't it be great if we could somehow incapacitate a major aircraft carrier? The police had done a number of raids on Panther offices. Couldn't we do something to draw the police attention and impair their ability to concentrate on the Panthers? The Bureau's counter-arguments were patient and clear. We will never be a match for the government's military might. Our strength in fighting for the oppressed is in potential numbers. The intensity of struggle around the world and within the U.S. does mandate a new level of struggle, but the model for us is armed propaganda, actions designed to educate about the oppressor and to show that there are ways to fight back without being crushed. While I heard these arguments, they weren't enough to overturn my newfound militarism. I was supposed to represent Denver at the national get-together to thrash out these issues. But in the chaos of the period, the Bureau contact who dealt with us lost touch. I never got the instructions on how to get to this clandestine meeting. Later, I wondered if he lost touch intentionally. Regardless of why I didn't get there, my presence and position at the meeting wouldn't have made much difference. Later, I was profoundly grateful to Bernadine Dorn, Jeff Jones, and Bill Ayers for leading us out of the volcano, for knowing what to do in a crisis that had way overwhelmed my own political understanding, and for leading the successful construction of an underground. That appreciation also had a downside in that it made it difficult for me to credit my own views in any differences I might have with them. But what mattered at the time was the new potential for building and sustaining a humane and coherent anti-imperialist underground. We were about to embark on a form of struggle that conventional wisdom deemed impossible and that was unprecedented in the U.S. since the 1950s and the abolitionist Underground Railroad. So that's talking about when they decided to go underground, but before they did it, they were forced underground, right?
Yeah.
So I'm ready
to break. This has been a lot of...
Those are a few. We just want to give you an idea of what the book sounded like. And we want to discuss it. Before we break, maybe people got some comments or questions?
Well, we did get a late start.
Oh, okay.
Typically, before we break,